State Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for July the 14th, 2019. Yep, we're midway through the month of July. Well, welcome to our weekly look at the world of politics and policy. We go from City Hall to the State House and all the way on to the White House. So, time to grab that Sunday paper, get that cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a great start. We'll do our best to get your week off to a great start, but I got to tell you, this weather is fantastic.
Summer's finally upon us.
Dave, remind me of this in December.
I certainly
okay?
will.
Because
I certainly will.
I mean, I was out on the storm center patio, and I think you can put the newsroom slip and slide back up now.
I'll have to dig it out. I think it was in storage in the transfer from Tribune Tower.
Did it make it?
I have to find out. Maybe I have to put some duct tape on some of the holes.
Well, that's all right. That's all right. No, but it is absolutely gorgeous out there. And you were out on the lake yesterday for the start of the Mac race.
Yeah.
And just the lovely photos and video that you shot out
there. Well, thank you. Yeah, and the day was just right for it. The 111th running of the Mac race yesterday, the racing division getting underway, and some of the bigger boats were ready to race. They were moving right from the gate. Friday was the start of the cruising division. Everybody making their way up there now. Some of the boats, actually, Rick, are quite close, relatively speaking, to the island, reaching the northern portion of Lake Michigan, the Manitou Islands, and going north there. That would be where the Traverse City, Lenoir Peninsula area is. So they're moving. That's a pretty good clip, considering that they started yesterday.
I kind of like the cruising division. That sounds... Play some 1950s rock and roll.
That's right. It's called that for a variety of reasons. Slower boats by design, really, and also maybe smaller boats. You know, the serious racing boats that maybe 60 to 70 feet are very sleek vessels.
Sure.
They're referred to as sleds.
Well, they're built for speed.
And they're built for speed, yeah. I can remember when I was in the race 5 years ago, we were virtually sitting still or becalmed, as they say, in northern waters. And one of the crew members said, "Hey, Dave, turn around." And I turned around, and one of the big boats, Windquest, which always is a front runner in the race, was just sliding right by us as we were sitting there being eaten alive by the bugs that are on the lake.
Well, see, that there is the advantage then in being one of those sled boats is that the bugs can't catch you,
the bugs
you, right?
won't get you. Yeah, right. You won't get any sleep. There's not many
to
stay or to sleep there, but yes, you are moving. In fact, Rick, just real quickly, I was looking at a chart yesterday, and the record is 23 hours from the start near Monroe Harbor to the actual crossing the bridge at Mackinac and heading toward the island. That's fast.
23 hours.
Yeah.
Wow.
You know, it's 289 nautical miles from Chicago. You're moving.
Oh, yeah. Wow. And you said some folks are just already about up there. Right?
They're up to the northern part of past the Manitous, going toward an area called Gray's Reef, where you make a great big bend to go east toward the island.
Wow.
Yeah. So they're moving.
And they have beautiful weather for it, too.
Yeah, everybody that's been reporting back says that conditions have been just great, despite the fact they've been facing a north wind.
Yeah, and I was kind of curious about that.
Yeah, well, the wind shifted. The wind shifted, and that was predicted, that the winds were going to shift, which means they have to tack, which is a maneuver to move back and forth to catch the wind to move in the right direction.
Right. Sounds like
fun. But that's part of the challenge of it. That's part of the challenge.
And it's a, I mean, it's a huge expanse of water that you're trying to navigate.
Yes, it is. In fact, if you're in the middle of the lake, right in the smack dab in the middle of it, you can't see land. That's how big it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're so used to seeing shorelines.
Yes, the lakefront and
close
right.
by and everything. But you get out in the middle of the lake, you can't see land for a while.
Oh, well, good luck to everybody. Everybody stay safe out there
absolutely.
On the water.
Yeah, and, much better conditions than last year. As
yeah,
you recall.
I remember that.
We had a situation where the very rough waters, and we lost a sailor.
Yes.
But the very different conditions this year.
Well, as I said, weather is great. I mean, if you don't grill today, if you've got a grill, you have to grill today. This is just perfect. But, you know, we joke about, you know, food and grilling and all that kind of stuff. And do you know what a horseshoe sandwich is, Dave?
Well, it's indigenous to Springfield.
Yes.
And let's just say that it's I wouldn't put it in the category of health food.
Well, no. So
tasty summer food, yes.
So a horseshoe sandwich is, and you don't find it a lot outside of Springfield. I mean, it's pretty much, you know, but it's basically a like Texas toast or a toasted piece of bread, and then some kind of meat like a hamburger or a grilled pork tenderloin, chicken breast, something like that. Then French fries. Then a cheese sauce ladled over the top of it.
See what I mean?
That's a lot of yellow.
That is, yes. But, so of course, our friends over at Channel 9, they do their, you know, on the noon news, they do their lunch break, right? And obviously someone had to send this to me. The Ironside Bar and Galley over on North Wells, they're doing a lobster horseshoe.
Ooh, that sounds good.
It didn't at first, okay? But then when I saw how they did it, and it's a toasted brioche with a hamburger patty, grilled hamburger patty with the Swiss cheese, then the French fries, homemade French fries, and then a Parmesan, like Alfredo sauce, and then lobster meat on top.
It's like a hillbilly surf and turf.
No, that's a high-end surf and turf, trust me.
Hamburger bun and, of course, your imported lobster from Maine.
Well, but that really sounds good, and I've got to go try that. I mean, that just...
Send me a report.
Well, I will. I mean, I posted a copy of the clip on Twitter and said, this is for my Springfield friends. Because ain't going to catch much lobster in the Illinois River, in the Sangamon River. That ain't going to happen. But I got to try that. Doesn't that really... That steps up the program, all right. That's for sure. Speaking of food, we got And the Taste of Chicago.
I walked.
Did you go?
No. truth be known, I didn't. I've walked by it because I've been, you know, down to Monroe Harbor for a couple of days, but I have not gone in. I didn't try the taste, and mainly because it wasn't open yet when I walked by.
Well,
you go?
No.
Yeah.
No. No. And truly, with the way the heat was up until yesterday, it almost reminds me of the state fair. The thought of, you know, with heat, humidity, and then the smell of like deep fried foods, that does not do anything for me. You know, just but you know, you've got that wrapping up, and quite frankly, hopefully that will restore some decency to the traffic patterns in this city because of those road closures.
Well, that's what I'm waiting for. But you know what? Bear in mind, won't be long. Lollapalooza.
Yes, yeah, I know.
And everything will be closed. You know, it's been good to have Balbo open as a thoroughfare between Lakeshore Drive and Michigan Avenue, other than just Roosevelt and Monroe. So having Balbo open is a help for that. Usually Balbo is closed for Lollapalooza, so that entire stretch from Monroe to Roosevelt is inaccessible for, you know, the setup, the festival itself, and the takedown.
Yeah. Oh, there's always something going on in this great city, isn't there?
Summertime, there really is. Yes. And you know, a friend of mine, a close friend of mine who is an avid boater, is from the South and pointed out to me when he lived here that he said, boy, people are really intense about the warm weather here, and they do as much as they can during the summer months. Summers are short.
Well,
so
yeah.
We do. Yes.
That's take advantage of it while you can. And, of course, we got summer baseball going on. And,
right.
And, Joe, what's going on with the White Sox?
You know, they have...
Is it just Oakland?
Apparently it is. The Bay Area is not a good place for the White Sox to be playing baseball. I mean, I think just things just got out of hand yesterday in a hurry, and Dylan Covey's first outing back off the injured list, and, you know, just kind of set the tone. And the Sox are a surprising team this year, but one thing they have had trouble with is getting off to bad starts, and they're not much of a comeback team, really. They've had some impressive wins, but those are the kind of the games that they just really haven't had a difficult time of pulling out victories in, and that kind of was the case yesterday.
Yeah, it's one of those where you just look at the score and it's like, oh my gosh, you know. But you know, it's almost the reverse, you know, on the North side.
It's the exact reverse.
Yeah.
7 runs, first inning, starter gets knocked out. It was crazy, the parallels.
12 batters, in the first inning.
John Lester swinging it.
Right. Home run, which I hate to say it, but I did note at one point in the game, the Cubs game, Lester's batting .262 and Addison Russell's batting .240. Okay,
wow.
So just some little context there, right?
I was looking it up. It was Lester's third home run. He's had one in the last 3 years. I mean, that's just what's so cool about, believe me, I'm all for the universal DH, but the fact that these players, these pitchers, are just such athletes, they're still capable of driving the ball out of the ballpark.
Yeah, I mean, and Lester's just fun to Lester's fun to watch at bat. You know,
he is.
I mean, because you're not expecting a home run, but you know, he can swing the bat, and I'm sure the opposing pitchers know you can't take them for granted. You know, you can't just throw up the lollipops there.
Well, and that's always what's frustrating when you're the opposing pitcher, because, you know, if you start working around the guy and you walk him, it's like, really, I just walked the pitcher?
Yeah,
why,
right.
Why not just challenge him with a fastball, and then you give that up? You know, it's a lose-lose situation, but obviously it's more of a win-win for the pitchers on the mound. But
so it's going to be interesting, and now that we're past the All-Star break, now it's time to step on the gas.
Yeah, I mean, for the Cubs right now, it's just so Cub to have this 4-day break, have a couple of really good games, you know, one little blemish on the 3-run homer coughed up by Stroke 2 days ago. Other than that, though, everything has just been peak Cubdom. And see, this is all we needed, a few days off, and now everything's great, and you know there's going to be a spell coming sometime. But it just shows that this team is still very talented, and they're able to piece together games like this. They just need to get on a run.
Yeah, but that Strope home run, I mean, you know, talk about you're cruising along 3-0, nothing. And actually, that was actually a great game.
It was.
With Darvish, and I mean, it was a pitcher's battle up to the 7th inning. It was fun to watch. And then the Cubs get out to a 3-0 lead, and figuring the way the game was going, well, that, you know, that's all you need. And then
right.
Kaboom.
I think the main takeaways were Darvish's stellar outing, the offense not giving up, and then, of course, Craig Kimbrel able to do it for another inning, too. It was nice
right.
to see him get a 1-2-3 frame. But, yeah, I mean, the Strope home run, Pedro Strope is still one of the guys, the late relievers that you rely on in that Cub bullpen. So, you know, one bad whack is going to happen. But, hey, Marte's really hot. I think he's homered 3 times in the series already.
Yes.
So
No, it's, and they're back at it today. Both teams back at it today, and we'll be keeping an eye on that. Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news. Joe Brand's got the latest sports. Producer Cassera's here to field your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin. We're on Twitter at @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is getting the grill out of storage. Remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune. Just to give you a quick what's up ahead for the show, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. Representative McSweeney prides himself on being against tax increases. We'll talk to him about the state's new taxes that took effect July 1 and discuss with him what are the alternatives. After the 8 o'clock news, we'll speak to my good friend, Tribune investigative reporter Hal Dardick. Hal had a piece in the Tribune recently about a sizable and questionable property tax assessment reductions that were being sought by Todd Ricketts, a member of the owning family of the Cubs and the finance chairman of the Republican National Committee. We'll get a final check of news and sports at 8:30, and then we'll speak to Kirk Dillard, former Republican state senator from Downers Grove, is the chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. We'll talk to him about what the recent gas tax increase, as well as the new capital program, means for improving mass transit in the region. That's all up ahead. Right now, it's time for a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN.
This is The Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin on this beautiful Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Skyline studio. I guess people were asking, still asking about that bacon blue cheese coleslaw. So it is great. It is great. I suggest adding extra bacon, double the recipe, use gorgonzola instead of blue cheese. The recipe is up on the Sunday Spin Facebook page, so you can find that there. Also, obviously, talking about the horseshoe, a text from the 217 area code. We are not hillbillies in Springfield. We are a very sophisticated community. I know. I lived there for 10 years. Yes, we all make fun of Springfield, the home of our state government. And the fact is, when I was in Springfield, I would occasionally have a horseshoe. And I was actually joking with somebody because they said, probably no one eats a horseshoe except visitors to our great city, is what the text said. And I was actually talking to somebody and I said, I think people have a view of Springfield that everybody eats a horseshoe every day, which obviously you can't. In the same way, people from outside Chicago think we eat deep dish pizza all the time. I mean, you just can't do it. But it is a culinary delight, the pizza and the horseshoe, and we'll give that a try as well. We're going to start our weekly spin through national politics, and we begin with a major concession from President Trump. Gone is the effort to try to put a citizenship question on the 2020 federal census. That the result of being frequently rebuffed by court challenges, including the U.S. Supreme Court. Instead, the president says the administration will use government databases, including Homeland Security's, to find out who is and who isn't a citizen. All of this with the Trump administration launching raids in various cities around the country, started in New York yesterday, according to the Wall Street Journal. On citizenship and the census, here's the president.
We will defend the right of the American people to know the full facts about the population, size of citizens and non-citizens in America. It is essential that we have a clear breakdown of the number of citizens and non-citizens that make up the U.S. populations. Imperative. Knowing this information is vital to formulating sound public policy, whether the issue is health care, education, civil rights, or immigration. We must have a reliable count of how many citizens, non-citizens, and illegal aliens are in our country.
That's the president speaking about the citizenship question. Also, before departing for Milwaukee on Friday, Trump announced that his labor secretary, Alex Acosta, had resigned over Acosta's strange plea deal with newly recharged sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Then he went after Democrats as they prepare to bring former special counsel Robert Mueller into congressional hearings that are planned for later this month.
How many bites at the apple do you get? We've gone through 500 witnesses, 2,500 subpoenas. I've let them interview my lawyers. I've let them in because I had nothing to do with Russia. Now that's come out. There was no collusion. But how many people and how many times? And this has been going on for 2.5 years. Rush Limbaugh said there's nobody else in the world that he knows that could have taken it. And on top of taking it, I've been a great president. I've done more. Listen. I've done more in 2.5 years than any other president. Nobody's even close, including, we just said, Veterans Choice and all of the other things I've got. But for 2.5 years, so now they have Mueller go make a speech. That goes. Now they want to have him again. They want to go it again and again and again because they want to hurt the president for the election because I see what I'm running against. You got sleepy Joe Biden. He doesn't have the energy to be president. And the people that are nipping on his heels, they don't have what it takes.
That is the president of the United States. Well, joining me now on the phone is Representative Dave McSweeney of Barrington Hills, Republican state representative. And he is a noteworthy opponent of tax increases. All you have to do is look at your Twitter account. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you, Rick. It's good to see John Lester back in good form yesterday, hitting and pitching.
Isn't it? And Darvish the day before. I mean, this is hopefully the start of something good for the second half.
I hope so. It's looking like a good start, and hopefully a sweep today.
Well, when you look at the standings, by the way, you know the Cubs in first in its division, you know, but they're only 6 games over 500. You've got these other teams throughout the majors, you know, 23 games over 500. This isn't the season I thought we were going to get, but we digress. Let's bring things back to Springfield, and obviously, you know, July, what took effect were the budget tax increases that occurred. And you have frequently said you think there's a better way. I guess I wonder, when you look at some of the obligations that the state faces, where are we supposed to be able to make up for the money for things like the Capitol bill, for example? Illinois needed a Capitol bill.
Let's start off with just the general budget. The governor, who is the self-proclaimed most progressive governor in the country, proposed a operating budget at $38.7 billion. We ended up at $39.9 billion. So we ended up spending $1 billion more than the most progressive governor. And in that budget, there is roughly $1 billion worth of tax increases. There's an online sales tax increase. There is also a tax on insurance companies and a tax on corporations that are trying to bring their money back to the United States. And what we really need, and the number one issue facing the state of Illinois on the state and local level, is we need pension reform. And specifically, we need to address the issue that the benefits are increasing at a rate of 3% every year. Inflation's only been 1.5%. And specifically, that takes a constitutional amendment. A lot of people, Rick, say, well, you can't address that, that it's impossible to do, that we have to just pay all these increases in the future. Nobody's talking about cutting existing benefits, but unless we address pensions, there's no way to tackle the major problems that we have in this state. Even with this budget that includes the tax increases, record-setting spending, we still have $6.8 billion of unpaid bills in this state. So specifically, a constitutional amendment that ties increases to half the rate of inflation, just like the Tier 2 system that is set up for new employees in the state, I think is imperative. The other part of it is Medicaid. 25% of the people in the state of Illinois qualify for Medicaid benefits. In Wisconsin, it's 17%. This administration is willing to entertain waivers that will allow savings in the future under the Medicaid program, while certainly protecting the truly needy. Anybody below 175% of the poverty level should not be touched. So in the operating budget, we need pension reform, we need Medicaid reform, we need to address the group health insurance issue, and unfortunately the governor just signed a contract that's very favorable to the public employee union, AFSCME, that allows a $2,500 bonus, that allows 11% increase in spending over the next 4 years. On the capital bill, we spend $2.2 billion already a year on roads, and there's no doubt that we need to spend that more efficiently. And what I favored is to have a modest expansion of gambling, sports gambling, as the base of that, and to use that to issue bonds based on a capital bill, which you probably could have gotten up to a $2.5-3 billion program. So I do believe that we need to spend money more efficiently in the lockbox, but we also need to make sure that we are funding our roads. There was a better way of doing it. The gas tax, doubling the gas tax, I think is a big mistake. I think that's going to hurt low-income and middle-income families, and we're going to see a lot of destruction. So the bottom line theme is that we need to reduce spending in the state, not raise taxes.
Well, but when you look, let's talk about capital, for example, and the fact that we've not had any kind of major capital program for a decade, and the fact that the gas tax itself had not been increased since 1996. When you look at, you know, on an inflation adjusted level, that gas tax would be at 38 cents. It'd be what the doubling is. With all of the unmet needs for infrastructure, everybody without partisanship talks about one of the state's greatest strengths is having this huge transportation infrastructure. You know, we are the gateway to everywhere, but we haven't maintained that gateway. And I mean, the amount of money that it takes to do maintenance, let alone try to do something new, is an astronomical cost. And how can you not do it without raising taxes?
Well, two parts of it, again, is we're spending the $2.2 billion a year already before the capital bill, and a lot of that is, in my view, not spent efficiently. There was a study that came out a couple years ago that shows that only 52% of the money that's in the road fund is actually being spent on road maintenance. It's being spent on administrative expenses and being spent on some pretty high prevailing wage rates that are making these projects a lot more costly. But what I favored, in addition to spending that money more efficiently, is using the sports gambling expansion as a way to develop a revenue base to issue bonds. Instead, they're using the gambling money for a pretty massive expansion of what they're calling your vertical programs, buildings, and as you know, a lot of that turns out to be special projects for members that was either buried in the budget or be part of the earmark. So spending money more efficiently, the $2.2 billion a year that we're spending already, and using gambling, I think, was a much better alternative. But this gas tax, as you know, Illinois not only has the 38-cent gas tax now that will increase at the rate of inflation, so roughly a penny a year it will increase, but it allows counties to actually also raise their gas tax, and I think some of those will do that. And there also is a sales tax in the state of Illinois on gas. So I am concerned about the effect this is going to have, especially on low-income families in the state. We already have a very high tax burden on when you combine the income tax, property taxes, sales tax, and now the gas tax.
We're speaking with State Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio, joined on the phone by Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. And we're talking to the representative about his opposition to some of the myriad tax increases that were approved by the General Assembly. We were talking about the Capitol bill, Representative. A couple of people texting, you noted the issue of prevailing wage on state construction projects, basically that public contracts construction work, workers have to be paid the prevailing union wage in that location. And they're asking, are you against prevailing wage?
So specifically, what we have done in the General Assembly is we made a change that actually expands the prevailing wage to actually increase it. In fact, that was done. I voted against that about 2 years ago in the General Assembly. So what I want to make sure, obviously, is that people are paid adequate wages, but we should not be in a situation that we are changing the indices, which we did in the state, to actually make it even more expensive. So my point is that we need to make sure that this money is spent efficiently, and we've actually gone the other direction in this state by changing the definition of prevailing wage to make it even more expensive.
So are you against prevailing wage?
No, I am not against prevailing wage as a policy. What I'm against is the change that happened that actually makes it even more expensive and ties it even more expensive indices. That's my position, that we need to spend this money more efficiently, but especially the $2.2 billion that we're spending right now.
Also on capital, and you kind of touched on this, and you know, we have the lockbox amendment now in this state that basically monies raised for transportation have to go for transportation improvements. Doesn't that lockbox provide more assured spending, more responsible spending than the previous way that people always used to raid money out of the road fund to fund general operations of government? Isn't there more assurance that, as you say, you want to make sure that the money is being spent, you know, for a stated purpose?
It should. In fact, that's one of the reasons that I supported that constitutional amendment, to make sure that we didn't raid that money in the future, that we could spend that money efficiently. And that's one of the reasons that we never have given that opportunity for that money to be used more efficiently for a prolonged period of time without dramatically now doubling the gas tax. So theoretically, one of the reasons that the proponents use for the amendment is that money would be spent more efficiently. We didn't give that time and said we're doubling the gas tax, and again, that's hitting low-income people really hard in this state.
So for you, it's kind of a wait and see on the efficiency of how that money's going to be spent?
It is, but we didn't even give an opportunity to see how that money is being spent. We just now have doubled the gas tax revenues going into that fund, and we also made, again, the change in the prevailing wage indice to actually make it even more expensive over a period of time.
You touched, obviously, on pensions. I'm curious about when you say, you know, to use a constitutional amendment to reduce the cost of living adjustment, what guarantees are there that that could be done to the existing workforce?
So Arizona, as you know, has a very similar constitution to us, and they were able to do it. And what it takes is leadership from the governor. I thought Governor Pritzker, with his $3.6 billion of wealth, was going to be an independent force in trying to at least bring about a resolution of these issues around pensions and labor issues. But instead, he's totally taken the position that he's going to give the unions whatever they want. So I think there was an opportunity with the AFSCME contract to negotiate wages and work rules and health insurance benefits and pensions and try to come up with a negotiated deal that would make it even more likely that it would be upheld at the Supreme Court. But it's going to take a constitutional amendment. There is absolutely no doubt about it. And for people who say that you can't do that, their only alternative is to raise taxes. And people in this state are sick and tired of the tax increases. They're moving out of the state. We're losing population. And, of course, we have the second highest property taxes in the country. And specifically, that is driven by pension obligations at the local level, too. So we badly need pension reform in the state, and we need a constitutional amendment.
But what surety is there that the constitutional amendment you talk about would actually be constitutional in and of itself?
Well, we have the precedent in Arizona, a very exact same constitution, and they've been able to uphold the constitutionality of that provision.
I'm not sure that actually was challenged in court.
Anything that's going to be challenged in court is, you know, even the changes they made for, you know, the substitute teacher in the state only worked for one day. That was a much easier situation because they said it was negotiated on a global basis. So that would be the actually best way to do it here in the state. The governor has missed that opportunity. And it's not a cost of living adjustment, in my view. It's actually an increase of benefits every year because it's 3% compounded annual increase in Illinois now, and inflation is only 1.5%. It's increasing our obligations every year. But I do believe there is a way to do it, and it has to be a constitutional amendment.
Again, I'm still not certain that leaves a lot of question about under contract clause and those kinds of things about whether you could actually affect the benefits that workers receive right now in the future. I mean, it would seem that the Illinois Supreme Court decision under the changes that were attempted under Governor Quinn, the Supreme Court was pretty clear that what the conditions were of employment when you got hired, that lasts through until you leave the job.
And that's why, definitely, in my view, in order to get it done, needs a constitutional amendment. As you know, the bill that was passed and was declared unconstitutional was done as a bill and not a constitutional amendment. And I think we have to use that Arizona case as the way to design a program. Because if we don't address pensions in the state, the only alternative that people will continue to present is raising taxes. And you look at the tax burden in the state, the income tax increase, and of course, we wouldn't even talked about the progressive tax proposal that'll be on the ballot next year. There'll be another massive tax increase. We have to address pensions.
In your view, do you think that change in the income tax structure in the state will be ratified by voters?
I don't. It's going to take 60% of the people voting on that question or 50% of the people voting on all the elections that day. It's either one determined. That's a pretty high mark. The governor spent $171 million for his campaign. He only got 54% of the vote. Hillary Clinton only got 56% of the vote in the state. So I think it's going to be difficult to get to that point, but it's going to be a very, very hard-fought battle. As you know, the governor, as I mentioned, has $3.6 billion. He's not afraid to spend a lot of his money on TV ads. So I think it's going to be very close, but I think we're going to be able to defeat it.
Well, we'll be watching because I think that's going to be the most expensive thing that's going to be on the ballot in Illinois in 2020 is going to be that provision. Representative David McSweeney, Republican from Barrington Hills, as always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Great. Thank you, Rick.
Now the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking a beautiful, gorgeous sunrise on, well, the sun has risen. It was a beautiful sunrise over Lake Michigan as the MAC race is ongoing and a beautiful day on the river. This is just everything you'd ever want on a picture-perfect Sunday in Chicago. I know we always kind of do a spin through national politics, but this one's got a little bit of a twist of international politics. We spoke last week about the release of documents from the British ambassador to the United States, Sir Kim Derrick, about his comments involving President Trump. And the furor became so great that Derrick resigned last week. Here's British Prime Minister Theresa May speaking to Parliament.
I have spoken to Sir Kim Darroch. I have told him that it is a matter of great regret that he has felt it necessary to leave his position as ambassador in Washington. The whole cabinet rightly gave its full support to Sir Kim on Tuesday. Sir Kim has given a lifetime of service to the United Kingdom, and we owe him an enormous debt of gratitude. Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice. I want all our public servants to have the confidence to be able to do that. And I hope the House will reflect on the importance of defending our values and principles, particularly when they are under pressure.
Now, the British Foreign Secretary, Jeremy Hunt, he led a free media conference, and Hunt supported Kim Darroch, Sir Kim, staying as ambassador. But when you listen to what the foreign secretary is saying, it's clear what he's referencing in his remarks.
Today we send a resounding message that media freedom is not a Western value, but a universal value. The strongest safeguard against the dark side of power is accountability and scrutiny. And few institutions fulfill that role more effectively than a free media. In the end, we all face a choice. Ignore the threats, and we tolerate the stifling of independent voices and the dangers of unaccountable power. But defend our values, and nations will flourish from the free exchange of ideas.
That's British Foreign Secretary Jeremy Hunt defending the enemy of the people, as one noted politician calls them. We're switching gears now, bringing things local, and joining me now on the phone is my good friend and colleague, Hal Dardick, member of the investigative team of the Chicago Tribune. Hal, good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
Wanted to have you on because of this very fascinating story that you worked on and spent a lot of time working on, as I know, involving Chicago Cubs co-owner Todd Ricketts. And I guess I'd like you to really maybe spend just a couple of minutes here just explaining, set up what was going on here with Todd Ricketts and his home in, was it Wilmette?
Yes, it's in Wilmette. Okay. He's maybe 5-6 blocks from Lake Michigan, a nice neighborhood in Wilmette. I don't think there's any bad ones there. But what he did was he bought a couple of properties in Wilmette for about $2.5 million, and he knocked down both homes. And he built a new designer, very modern home by a noted architect that was about twice the size of the original house on one of those lots. But the assessor in Cook County continued to value his property as though both of the old homes he had torn down were still there. And so what Ricketts did was he went in through an attorney and he appealed those two assessments. One, he said, well, it's a vacant lot because the house is no longer there, which was accurate. And because of that, they reduced the value of that property. But he also, when he went to the Board of Review, appealed the property with his new house as though the old house were still there. And because that old house is about half the size, about 2,500 square feet versus about 5,000 for the new one, it's assessed at a much lower value, and it would trigger a much lower tax bill, thousands of dollars every year. But he contended in his appeal, or his attorney did, at the very least, that that old house was still there, and so he got the assessment lowered based on the value of that old house. So over since he built that house in 2010, over the years he's saved easily tens of thousands of dollars in property taxes. We were able to figure that all out, and it's part of a system that's very troubled. A lot of the data is inaccurate, but I think what makes this story particularly unique, not just because he's Cubs co-owner and Republican National Committee Finance Chairman, is the fact that he appealed it, asserting that old house were still there. State law, I don't know that everybody's familiar with it, but requires people to notify the assessor when you've built a new home so they can come out and reassess it. Since they started asking about it, they're going to go out there and do that. They can bill him for 1 year plus 3 years in arrears. The Board of Review is investigating the matter, but it's one very striking illustration of a a troubled property tax system in Cook County.
And that's what I want to talk to you about. Set up perfectly. We're going to take a quick break. We're speaking with Hal Dardick, a member of the investigative team from the Chicago Tribune, about the issue of Todd Ricketts' property tax appeal and what that says in a larger way about the system of property taxation in Cook County. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio and joined on the phone by Hal Dardick, my colleague and friend, a member of the investigative team at the Chicago Tribune. We're talking about a story that he very diligently reported on involving Todd Ricketts, the member of the Cubs owning family. Todd also the finance chair of the Republican National Committee and about the assessment that was granted on the new house that he had built in 2010 based on the fact that documents were submitted by his own lawyer that showed that it was not that house that he built in 2010. It was the old house that got knocked down to build that new house. Is that a good enough shorthand, Hal? I want to be legal here.
I think you did a great job. Okay. You should help me write this story, right?
No. You did just fine. But before we took that last break, you mentioned, and look, we all know that the property tax system in Cook County is a mess, and you've written extensively on that. But to me, this underscores, and the story kind of underscores just various kind of deficiencies. It's like, as you said, you know, if you build a new house, you're supposed to notify the assessor. You've got finger pointing going on between, you know, various people here over whether somebody was notified and or not.
Right. The village of Wilmette said it sent the building permit along to the township assessor, which then where they say they relayed it to Cook County Assessor. They say that they don't have any record that they ever received it. Interestingly, they don't forward building permit information, which state law also requires the local village provide. And I don't want to single out Wilmette because I think this is going on all over Cook County. And the computer system is ancient. I think it's an abacus with wires hooked up. And they are in the process of installing a new state-of-the-art computer system, which should help them do a better job. But the experts tell me that there are any number of these examples where what the assessor thinks is on the property is not there. They're out of date, so it throws everything out of whack. It's not as fair as it should be. People aren't being assessed the proper amount, and there's just so much work for this new assessor to do, who's working on fixing the models that were overtaxing low-price homes and under-taxing higher-priced homes that we documented in the tax divide series, and putting commercial assessments, what he says are up to realistic valuations that are higher, and they have to value 1.8 million parcels of property every 3 years, and he had an audit done by the International Association of Audit of Assessing Officers when he came into office, and they said, with the staff you've got, you can inspect and know what's on every property once every, I think it was 34 years.
34 years, yes.
And they should be doing that every 4 to 6 years. So they're trying to harness technology, aerial satellite technology that can tell them very precisely what's on a property to make that system more efficient. But there are so many things to repair. And as you know from covering politics and Illinois government for years, the one thing that people feel isn't fair and is regressive is the property tax system, and this just sort of shatters the trust that people have that, even if they don't like it, you know, and maybe they understand the need for it, that they're being taxed fairly.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, well, one, the tax divide kind of shook that to its core for Cook County taxes. But, you know, when you first kind of explained the story to me, and it's like, well, did anybody, you know, go out to the property to see what the new house looks like from the assessor's office? I mean, which would seem like a normal thing, right?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. That's what is supposed to happen, and it's actually outlined in state law that it's supposed to happen, but it did not. And I don't think this is the only property where that's going on.
Well, and I mean, where does Assessor Kagi fall in as far as being able to get increased staff?
Well, we'll see. He said that he's working on that. We have yet to see County Board President Tony Preckwinkle's budget proposal for the next year. I think that they're financially strapped. He may have to get more inspectors by shifting around resources. He may have to perhaps get some funding to harness this aerial photograph system that they have so that it can trigger some sort of awareness every time a change like this happens on a property. But there's no way with the county's budget constraints is going to get the kind of staffing that was recommended in this audit of his office. And so we don't know exactly how or if they're going to be able to fully address this issue.
We've got someone texting saying, don't the building permits go to the assessor?
That's a very good question. And state law does require that they do, but there's sort of a hodgepodge with the county's 30 suburban townships and the city of Chicago and what sort of information that they do transmit to the assessor. It seems like a lot of these local officials are unaware of that requirement, and sometimes they're just triggering building permits, which may or may not get done and requires repeated inspections to see what happened on the property. But if the assessor says he's now trying to work with all those township and officials in the city of Chicago to make sure that those building permits do get sent, and that's the most your listener there is right on point. That's the most logical way for the system to work better is every time there's a building permit gets sent to the assessor automatically sends out an inspector to determine the characteristics of that home, the square footage, the age, the amenities, so that it can be properly assessed.
Also, a texter asked, what year did the Ricketts attorney appeal? So the house was built in 2010, as I recall.
Right. So he appealed in 2013. What he was able to do when he appealed at that point was appeal the 2013 assessment for the 2014 taxes in the previous 3 years, although to get a certificate of error to make sure it was that it was changed and you get some sort of refund. But so he was able to take care of it since 2010 through those processes. Just to be clear, though, the appeal for the property that had the old house that was replaced by the new one only was for the 2013 assessment for 2014 tax year because the state law does not allow you get a certificate of error on prior assessments that were valuation based as opposed to whether it was a vacant or used property.
That's a very good point. So right now we have the investigation that's going on by Board of Review, Assessor's Office, and basically we just need to wait and see what they come up with, correct?
That's right. The assessor is in the process of redetermining the value of the property. The Board of Review is actually interviewing people involved in that appeal. They will come out with the report at some point that sort of will be an analysis of what happened and with perhaps recommendations of what should be done about it.
We'll be watching that. I know you will be. Hal Dardick, my good friend and colleague at the Chicago Tribune, a member of the investigative team. Great work on this story. Thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Always my pleasure, Rick.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me here in the studio, I'm very happy to have Kirk Dillard. He is former Republican state senator from Downers Grove, who is the chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. I still have to call you senator, right?
You know, I go by dad mostly, but
oh, I'm not calling
call
you
whatever,
dad.
Whatever you want.
Well, actually, I want to thank you. You were just saying that you were at the Windy City Cookout last night. So
yeah, the Windy City Smokeout. You know, it's a busy day for transit. It is every day. But the Taste of Chicago,
right?
Cubs game, and the Windy City Smokeout, which is at the United Center. So like every day, the men and women of the CTA, Metra, and the PACE system are busy.
Well, and I mean, earlier on, I was talking about how there's something all the time in the summer in this city, and you know that's got to tax the transportation network.
It does. Obviously, the Chicago Police Department and Fire Department, you know, are working around the clock and get burdened by, and burden's not the right word, but they're very busy with a lot of the events. But the same holds true for mass transit. And in Chicagoland, we operate 24 hours a day. I mean, London doesn't operate 24 hours a day, but we, this is a city that works. And, you know, when you wake up in the morning and you want your newspaper or you want to go get your muffin or coffee, somebody rode the CTA there in the middle of the night to prepare you or prepare whatever you're going to have when you're going to work.
So now we finally, after having you on this show for how many years talking about
begging for money,
yes, and it was kind of embarrassing when you were out in front of the old showcase studio on Michigan Avenue with the paper cup. I thought that was taking it a bit too far, but we now have a capital bill. A long-awaited capital bill, and it's a, you know, a $33 billion transportation component, I believe, of the $45 billion. Now, that's roads, bridges, that's everything. I'm not sure what transit gets out of that.
We get about 20%,
well, that's not enough, right?
It is, but it's a great start. when you've been starved for capital or infrastructure money for a decade, it's a great start. I will tell, you know, the listeners, we have a $30 billion backlog of just state of good repairs, is the terminology in the transit business. That is just to keep the system like it is.
Level.
And there's some new things that are in this bill. But we get, you know, we get probably $2.7 billion in bonding for transit capital projects over the next 5 years. We get $250 million, very importantly, first time ever. I thank Governor Pritzker and the legislators. We get $250 million in pay-as-you-go stable funding. And, you know, better funding means better rides, Rick. That's the bottom line. We have been cash-starved for a decade, and Metra's lined up to buy 40 new locomotives. I kid people, used to ride in from Naperville on Metra. The car I ride in from the western suburbs was delivered when Dwight Eisenhower was the president.
It's very obvious too when you look at
it looks new, but it's ready for Medicare, and you've got to replace your equipment. And you know, if you're trying to get home to your child's soccer game, or you want your employees to show up in the business district of Chicago and you know, without delay, 70% of everybody that works in the Chicago business district takes mass transit to work. You've got to replace your equipment every 40, 50, or 60 years.
Well, and I, you know, you're speaking of like the BNSF, and you wonder at what point can they still find parts?
Good questions. Like Assessor Kagi's, which we heard with Hal Dardick on the previous system, computer system. But, you know, over 2 million people ride the RTA system every day. That's 1/6 of Illinois. You know, in your horseshoe segment, you talked about how you lived in central Illinois. I try to tell downstaters that 1/6 of the population of Illinois every day rides the mass transit system. And it's great for everyone. This is just Metra. It's not the CTA. If we didn't have Metra, you'd have to build 27 more lanes of highway on the Stevenson, Kennedy, Dan Ryan. Obviously, we don't have the space, nor do we have the money. But even if you don't take mass transit, you save $400 a year. We talked to you on your segment with Representative McSweeney, talked about how the legislature adjusted the gas tax, which hadn't been adjusted for inflation in 40 years. You save $400 a year if you're a rush hour driver just in fuel savings. As crowded as the Eisenhower may seem, you'd have to spend $400 a year more in gas because you'd be stuck on there for longer than you even are. And if you're we estimate that every Metra rider saves non-riders about $4,000 a year by reducing congestion and increasing safety accidents. We're in the Allstate studio. Allstate will tell you that means fewer auto accidents because the roads are not as congested as they may seem. But, 2 million people, you put them on the expressways, it's gridlock.
Well, and as you said, we can't build that kind of a system for
you can't
vehicles.
And Rick, I think, you know, I grew up in Chicago. I've been here my entire life. Took the CTA as a kid. We have one of the great legacy systems in transportation anywhere in the world. We're going to improve it. We may take the red line farther south, but we need to keep what we have because it is a tremendous system. It can always be improved, but our grandparents have built the best system, I think, anywhere in America.
Actually, we have texter asking, is the Orange Line 24 hours?
The Orange Line essentially is a 24-hour line. Speaker Madigan is probably the Orange Line's, along with Representative Lipinski,
yes.
Biggest component or proponent. So, the Orange Line essentially runs around the clock, and it's a workhorse line.
I curious about BNSF, and you know, that's been a problem plagued line, and I know part of it is this implementation of the new positive train control to prevent accidents. It's something that's mandated by the federal government for all railroads. We've gotten little extensions for time period, and it's an expensive proposition.
It's a $400 million unfunded mandate that will cost $10 to $20 million a year forever.
I know that's part of it, but what else is going on to try to get BNSF, that Naperville route going?
Well, I certainly think, I mentioned Congressman Lipinski earlier. He sat down with the president as well as the officials from Metra, the president of Amtrak, as well as the BNSF. And, Union Station also needs to be improved. That's a station, if you want to be the transportation capital of America, we need to look like it. That's a gateway. More people go through Union Station every day than go through Midway Airport. I was in New York 2 weeks ago and toured Grand Central Station, Philadelphia, Denver, a lot of the other cities have made their stations like Union Station.
Some of the great
gateways for non-riders, where you go on a weeknight and have dinner, and there's a proposal. It is probably $1 billion proposition where BMO Harris is going to build their headquarters next to Union Station. Air rights is the name of the game. In fact, as we sit in this Allstate studio, Millennium Station's right below us. You don't even have to get, if Steve Cochran wants to come to work in the morning, he can take and go into Millennium Station and never have to go outside in the dead of winter. Today's a great day to walk around outside, but Union Station, coupled with the old post office renovation, will just absolutely make the near west side take off, sort of like the Fulton Market area has done. So there's a plan to really use air rights to renovate Union Station. Can't wait for that. But we are all over the Burlington Northern, Santa Fe, as well as Amtrak, our friends at Metra and the congressman working to continue to improve it. But I ride that line every day, and I get as frustrated as any of the riders with what used to be almost a perfect system.
It was. It had the best on time record. It was.
But the new capital bill will help. It'll certainly alleviate many of the mechanical delays you get on your apps and iPhones. I think they're going to replace up to 40 new locomotives. So it'll be a better ride, and better funding does mean better rides.
And actually, what they've done with the renovation at Union Station so far is actually.
It's very magnificent.
Nice.
It blows my mind, and I've been around as in the governor's office and in the state senate, how expensive some of these repairs are. I'm not sure everybody has a grasp of...
It's not just paint.
It's unbelievably expensive, but we're moving a sixth of Illinois every day.
We're speaking with Kirk Dillard, the chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson, the Chicago Tribune, joined by Kirk Dillard, chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. We're here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Just a couple of quick questions. We were talking about BNSF. A question, why is BNSF line have more problems than all the other lines?
In a nutshell, it has the oldest equipment. So as the new capital bill kicks in, they'll get the newest equipment probably more quickly than the other lines.
And it's one of the heavier lines, too.
And it's clearly the workhorse line, most riders.
Another question. Please consider extending Metra 1 to 2 hours at night so healthcare workers, many, can make it to the last train.
It's a great suggestion. And again, better funding means better rides. And because of the capital bill, we won't be cutting any service.
And potential to expand.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, and this seems like we talked overall about what a workhorse mass transit is in the region, but this is what fuels the economy.
There's no doubt. And Rick, these are studies from the Metropolitan Planning Commission. Mary Sue Barrett heads that up. These are incredible statistics. In the last 10 years in metropolitan Chicago land, so it's the seven county metro area, 85% of all new commercial construction was within a half a mile of mass transit. 50% of all jobs created in the metropolitan Chicago area, again, within a half a mile of mass transit. And 76% of all new multifamily housing starts within a 10-minute walk to the CTA or Metra. Where mass transit goes, the economy grows.
We're not just talking Chicago. We're talking the seven-county region.
Absolutely. And it's all about transit. The reason Chicago leads America in corporate relocations, whether it's McDonald's now moving to the Fulton Market area, I can go on and on and on, is mass transit. And if you want to keep your millennials and Generation X's and Z's here in Chicago, they live by mass transit and Uber. It's a generation that takes mass transit and Uber more than my generation.
So you brought up Uber. I'm curious how I don't know if there's actual studies. There probably have been about how does Uber affect something like the CTA?
It has an impact, and I look at Uber. If we do Uber and Lyft properly, or the rideshare companies, they're a good partner with us. Metra has a partnership with Uber. It certainly solves a lot of our last mile issues, which is great. One of the things, just human nature, is more people take the Blue Line now, and there's some great Blue Line improvements coming with the new capital bill. More people now jump on the Blue Line out of O'Hare, and they may go and take the Blue Line, into the city, and then they'll grab an Uber to go meet their wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, whomever, at a restaurant or go home. And Uber and Lyft can be a great partner. Now, one of the problems is they cause more congestion, which slows down our buses, which, Alderman Hopkins and I have talked ad nauseum about how Uber drivers clearly slow down buses in the Gold Coast.
but what do you do?
First of all, you've got to make sure that Uber drivers know where they can and cannot pick up people.
Good luck with that.
You know, not in front of
a
bus stop. But we'll work with it. I know Mayor Lightfoot has ideas with respect to ride sharing. Want to let her catch her breath as the new mayor, and we'll work through it. But Uber and Lyft, if done properly, can be decent and good partners with them.
You have a partnering with the scooter companies?
We do not. And actually, if there's any of the CTA bus drivers or Pace bus drivers out there, you gotta. It's just one more hazard that they have to deal with every day.
Another question on the text line: who's responsible for fixing bridges on the UP North?
It would be Metra, and let me tell you, that's a great question. So Metra has about 800 bridges. 400 of those bridges, Rick, are more than 100 years old, and there are still some that are made out of timber. So the capital bill is a great start from Springfield. It's not enough. Hopefully, President Trump and Washington will give us their
long-awaited trillion-dollar.
Infrastructure bill, because federal money is just critical. And our congressional delegation does a great job of returning federal transportation monies. It's one of the few areas where we actually win as a state, but we need a couple trillion-dollar federal bill as well.
Are you optimistic?
I don't know. The president, Congressman Bustos from the Quad Cities, told me that Speaker Pelosi went in with Chuck Schumer, the Democrat leader in the Senate, said, "How about a trillion eight?" And the president goes, "Let's just round it up to two trillion with a T." I'm optimistic because the one area of bipartisanship you can find in Springfield or in Washington, and this country needs more bipartisanship for sure, but it's important to the economy, is you can find common ground. The state chamber of commerce and the business leaders were begging for a capital bill. They swallowed a gas tax increase, although it's just an inflationary increase because it hadn't been increased since Jim Thompson was the governor. So it was like 1989, I think, was the last one. So it's really an inflationary adjustment. But the one area you can find bipartisanship in Washington and Springfield, as we just proved, is infrastructure, because it makes your economy go.
That's Kirk Dillard. He is the chairman of the Regional Transportation Authority. As always, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
On this beautiful day.